packets or 100 packets of cigarettes, and they put him in jail for 3 years.
Where's the justice in that?
That's civilized. Yeah. Okay, so that's civilization. Yes, we are the barbarians. Yes?
Yeah. Is that's what they want us to think.
Is that the case?
No, it's not.
I would clearly submit that, yes, if you look at the Takfiri caricature, organ-eating, liver-cutting-out Islam, yes, they're no doubt they're barbarians.
Barbarians, yes.
But this, what Imam taught us, this Islam, this complete package, where it includes everything, you know, jihad is not warmongering. Jihad is defending yourself. It's justice.
It's justice.
This is what human
defending
nature
your rights.
Does. You defend your family. You defend your home. You defend your city.
Sure.
You defend your nation.
Sure.
Okay? This is what human beings do. Real human beings do these things.
Sure.
So I think that's really the bottom line, that we have to see this as a package. And thank God, we thank God that we have leaders and had leaders like Imam who taught us what real Islam is.
Dr. Mahdi Trabi, thank you very much indeed. On that note, that was a wonderful contribution there. I hope our listeners benefited from what we said, because there were some very, very important points in what you discussed there. But it just leaves me to say, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Hello there and welcome to The Light, a unique remnant of bygone days. Archaeologists have found a rare ancient Roman ceremonial carriage outside Pompeii. The carriage was unearthed near the stables of a village just outside the very city. It has four wheels and is made of iron, bronze, and tin. The vehicle is the first of its kind discovered in the area. Italy's culture minister has called it a unique find without any precedent in the country. Pompeii was buried under ash and a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. So far, about two-thirds of the ancient city has been uncovered, I should say. The lights, merriment, and traditional food. That's what China's Lantern Festival has brought to millions of people across the country.
Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. Manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients.
Spring is coming, and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers, and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and the warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
The coronavirus and related restrictions have forced many businesses to either close or struggle. But some people have found ways to save their jobs and help others to survive the crisis. A top German chef is the one. Peter Frusamer now prepares dishes at a hospital canteen outside Berlin. Frusamer says before accepting the job, he was the head chef at his wife's restaurant. But it was closed due to the pandemic, and he chose to be a hospital cook rather than a jobless man. This German chef says he is happy to find some distraction while working in a hospital kitchen, besides making a contribution to patients' recovery.
I find it frustrating to be here and see the empty tables and the empty restaurant. When I'm at the hospital, I don't notice any of this. For me, the coronavirus crisis doesn't exist at the hospital. Sure, corona is always a topic, but there, I'm at work and I'm busy. But when I come here, I notice what a cut is going through society. That's why I'm happy to have my hospital and to find some distraction. Here in the restaurant, I could actually sit down and start crying.
The hospital staff also seem happy with Frusamer's presence. They say since the arrival of the new chef, they come to eat in the canteen regularly and discover new dishes not eaten before. Frusamer believes the reason health workers and patients love his dishes is that he gives his heart and soul to the food.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view, as stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
For some people, it may take years to build a morning running habit. However, this very special runner seems very impatient in sticking to its daily running routine. The 2-meter-tall ostrich escaped its dwelling to run alongside vehicles on the streets of Beihai, South China. It even tried to keep up with a car's speed by jogging at a very fast pace. The bird's owner says it opened the gates of the farm it stayed in and escaped. He guided the fugitive bird back to the farm by covering his face with a red cloth. The video of the athlete ostrich went viral after its running was caught on traffic cameras.
Iran has inaugurated the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition according to health protocols. The event is aimed at injecting fresh energy into the tourism industry, which has been badly affected by COVID-19 over the past year. Saman Kujori reports.
Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has been inaugurated according to health protocols announced by the National Headquarters for Coronavirus Control and following the necessary coordination with the relevant agencies in this field. According to organizers, visiting the exhibition in person will be controlled. Only a specific number of people are allowed to visit each day. Officials and experts believe Iran will achieve a tourism boom after the coronavirus outbreak, believing its impact would be temporary and short-lived for a country that ranked the third fastest-growing tourism destination in 2019.
Although we were under sanctions and at the same time corona pandemic badly affected tourism industry across the country, we have developed and completed many projects in the country during this period. We are very optimistic about the future of tourism industry in Iran because we believe good days are around the corner. Iran is a historically and culturally rich country with abundant attractions.
According to the latest data, 8 million tourists visited the Islamic Republic during the first 10 months of the past Iranian calendar year. Iran ranks first globally in terms of the number of handicraft cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. The number of Iranian craft cities and villages stands at 14, while the second place goes to China, which has only 7 craft cities and villages globally registered.
Handicraft exports from Iran before the coronavirus outbreak reached $146 million in the Persian calendar year, which started in March 2019. Iraq and Persian Gulf littoral countries are among the main target markets for Iranian handicrafts.
Under the 2025 Tourism Vision Plan, the country aims to increase the number of tourist arrivals from 4.8 million in 2014 to 20 million in 2025.
Iran's tourism ministry has proposed travel packages under strict health protocols, with the hope of encouraging people to travel and injecting fresh energy to the tourism industry, especially during the upcoming Nowruz holidays. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The famous festival marks the final day of the Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations. This year, it fell on Friday. The festival is characterized by a wide range of activities. In eastern China, people make intricate fish lanterns that require exquisite skill to operate. In other parts of the country, celebrators make special buns and shape them like different animals. This year's festivities have brought people joy and lifted their spirits up amid the pandemic.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Donald Trump placed his perceived political interest over stopping a pandemic, says Mitchell Zimmerman, author, in an article published under the heading Trumpedemic. The coronavirus death toll reached 500,000 because Trump sabotaged the COVID response. Stay tuned for more. Economy devastated. 1 in 12 Americans sickened. Millions hospitalized. 500,000 dead. As we mourn 500,000 Americans who have died of COVID-19, we should remember that their deaths were not the inevitable results of a pandemic, not unavoidable acts of God. Most of the dead would likely be alive today. Most of the suffering America has endured could have been avoided but for Donald Trump. In Year of the Plague, Trump went from neglect and incompetence to sabotaging the national response, causing massive deaths. A cynical and self-absorbed man, Trump saw a lethal contagion only an opportunity for political gain. He calculated that his prospects for re-election would be advanced if he generated political warfare over the difficult steps public health authorities knew were needed. So he called coronavirus a hoax, mobilized his credulous base to go to war against public health officials, and systematically undermined efforts to confront the challenge. Trump understood coronavirus was no hoax. "This is deadly stuff," he told journalist Bob Woodward in interviews early on. "It's also more deadly than ever your strenuous flus." But Trump opposed actions disruptive of life as usual because he saw a rising stock market as key to re-election and feared that recognizing the crisis would spook the market. So he laid his political fortunes on opposing serious efforts to contain coronavirus and mobilized Republicans to resist precautions. Trump's assistants derail efforts at outset to limit the exponential spread of the disease. Epidemiology researchers from Columbia University concluded in May 2020, if the country had begun locking down cities and limiting social contact on March 1st, 2 weeks earlier than most people started staying home, the vast majority of the nation's deaths, about 83%, would have been avoided. In a mere 2.5 weeks from March 18 to the beginning of April, identified COVID-19 cases would leap from 8,500 to 240,000 and deaths from 145 to over 7,000. Tragically, this was only the beginning. Once the disease had spread so widely, reining it in became exponentially more difficult. Slowing COVID-19's spread was hindered by long-standing weaknesses in U.S. healthcare system and U.S. threadbare social safety net. The one person own and operate the corporate media. They are doing everything they can to defend the status quo, squash dissent, and protect the wealthy and the powerful. The number of people without health insurance grew in Trump years, practically among people of color and vulnerable groups. And with no national requirements for sick leave, 7 in 10 of the lowest paid workers have no paid sick leave. Millions who contracted COVID-19 were reluctant to quarantine and slow to seek medical care they couldn't afford and risk their jobs. Trump's attacks on undocumented immigrants threatening their status if they used public services also made many reluctant to resort to medical resources specifically intended to safeguard health. The crowded housing where the less well-off resident with health-impairing conditions such as pest, mold, chronic dampness, lead exposure, and inadequate heating exacerbated health risks. And people of color and the poor suffer disproportionately from asthma and other respiratory conditions that make them sitting ducks for COVID-19. All of these pre-existing social and health conditions have made tens of millions more vulnerable to coronavirus and accelerated its spread. Against this backdrop, Donald Trump turned to sabotage. He campaigned against social distancing, mask use, and closures. He convinced Republicans they were defending liberty when they behaved in a manner likely to spread infections, threatened public health officers, and defied public health requirements, inevitably thwarting the recommendations of by doctors, scientists, and public health leaders caused lives to be lost. No other country on earth has had as many coronavirus cases or deaths as the U.S. Combating a pandemic requires that the people of a country accept the need for sacrifice, that they act together, and that they have the support of their government to endure the death of loved ones, serious illness, loss of income, school closures, and limitations on contact with friends, family, and colleagues. It also requires government to recognize that the pandemic cannot be stopped unless the authorities address the reasons for vulnerability of those most afflicted. When instead a president mobilizes as many as a quarter or a third of the population to rebel against the discipline needed to contain the pandemic, it becomes nearly impossible to control the outbreak.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the region of South Asia, which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We'll try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the coup d'etat in Myanmar and the whole story behind the decades-long internal conflict. Then we throw more light on the after-effects of this drastic change for the Burmese people, as well as the regional and global perspectives on the unfolding events.
Burmese are out on the streets protesting against a coup in which Myanmar's ruling party, led by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, was deposed by the country's military. Daw Soo and President Win Myint, along with dozens of their ministers, their deputies, and members of the parliament, are being kept in confinement since many weeks, while the country is at the scene of almost everyday bloody clashes between the police and the people.
It was early in the morning of February 1st when Myanmar's military toppled the government, officially ending a short test run of democracy in the country. Should the day have unfolded as planned, the parliament was due to swear in the newly elected members, thereby enshrining the results of the November election. But the army took over the country to reinstall stratocracy, an amalgam of authoritarian ideas parading as majority-driven. Like all similar coup scenarios, the military cut all communication services, declared a state of emergency, and detained senior figures of the civilian government, most notably Daw Aung San Suu Kyi.
The military has played electoral politics, the game that they have lost. Every time they held elections and Aung San Suu Kyi and popular National League for Democracy contested. Yet in the last 30 years, since 1990, the military held five elections, including one by-elections, in 2012. The first one, 1990, second one, 2015, which NLD did not participate, and then 2012, and then 2015, and 2020. Four out of five past elections in 30 years, Aung San Suu Kyi and her popular National League for Democracy defeated the military-backed political proxies in the parliament in crushing or landslide wins. So therefore, the military as an institution did not want to play this game where they are beaten every single time they play against a popular democratic National League for Democracy.
The celebrity activist became the first elected head of state following about 20 years of opposition against the military junta, most of it in house arrest. She is the youngest daughter of Aung San, the father of modern-day Myanmar. He was the man who founded the new Burmese army. The dethroned ruling party was supposed to be Myanmar's comeback to the democratic world after over half a century beset with political instability, especially since 1948 when it declared independence from Britain.
About a decade ago, the country's military rulers felt they needed a more democratic look for better interaction with the international community. Emboldened by their sense of popularity among the Burmese, the military, or Tham Tharwa, decided to let Dosu's political party have a chance in the election 5 years later. Her sweeping victory was promulgated as the country's democratic rebirth. But in reality, almost everything was still under the junta's control.
Via Myanmar's military apparatus had made sure that key areas of power remain under its well-established reach, but the coup has revealed that Aung San Suu Kyi's wild popularity was still frightening for them. The general election in November sounded more alarms for the top brass as the National League for Democracy, Suu Kyi's party, won in a landslide and secured 85% of the seats. The main opposition party was led by the military and only garnered about 7%. It seems that the army did not manage to come to grips with the reality of their humiliating blow and called the election fraudulent. Most observers report otherwise. Despite the loss, the military still had enormous executive power as well as many reserved seats on top of the veto power over the parliament's reforms, thanks to their tailor-made changes in the constitution over the years.
Before the coup gave General Min Aung Hlaing complete authority over the country, Suu Kyi was about to start her new term as the state councillor, a position specifically invented for her. With powers akin to those of a prime minister, it was created to circumvent a phrase that bars anyone who has family members with other citizenships from becoming president. Suu Kyi's now deceased husband was British and her two children are UK citizens. But her power was limited as the military-drafted constitution reserves 25% of parliamentary seats for unelected military representatives, essentially preventing the NLD party from amending the constitution.
Myanmar's Tatmadaw had made sure that key areas of power remain under its well-established reach, but the coup has revealed that Aung San Suu Kyi's wild popularity was still frightening for them. Although the former arrangement of power was still a blend of civilian government along with a powerful military, this was the closest Myanmar had ever moved towards democracy. That window is closed now, but the people who experienced a touch of democracy during the last 5 years don't want the dark days back. The future is grim, and days are gloomy for the Burmese protesters who are getting injured and even killed during the military crackdown of the ongoing protests almost on a daily basis. Undeterred by the police killings, protesters have promised unrelenting demonstrations until their demands are met. On the other hand, the new boss of the country has warned of severe consequences for those who defy the orders. But the international community has called on the military to relinquish power and curb the heavy-handed crackdown. But what else could you expect from your typical Dawa military man?
The members of the Security Council expressed deep concern at the declaration of a state of emergency imposed in Myanmar by the military on the 1st of February and the arbitrary detention of members of the government, including State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint and others. They called for the immediate release of all those detained.
The Security Council, with its five veto wielders, is never going to agree on anything that is, you know, significant and impactful to the lives of like a billions of humans. And, you know, Security Council is for all intents and purposes in a perpetual coma because it's so torn by a conflicting geopolitical and economic interest among the top five world leaders or leading governments. And so I'm not surprised that, you know, Security Council failed once again to take any meaningful action. And secondly, I think this is also the body that failed to act in the face of a genocide. You know, genocide is international interstate treaty, and Myanmar is clearly found to be violating the terms of this treaty. And, you know, the Security Council has a responsibility to act, and it failed to do so. And so I'm not surprised that the, you know, the British table motion or statement did not garner enough support or consensus to, you know, it isn't even a binding resolution or anything. It's just a statement, condemning the coup. And then with respect to India and Vietnam, well, Vietnam is also a dictatorial one-party state, you know, operating under the banner of socialism or like a semi-communism. And the Vietnamese the military, Vietnamese telecom companies are in cahoots with the Burmese military and its telecom, industry run by the Burmese military and cronies. And so, you know, it's just a matter of like, you know, birds of the same feather sticking together. India is just an interesting case because India has not been supportive of Burmese democratic movement for the last 25 years or so, despite its initial support for democratic movement, in 1988. Indian military has also been courting the Burmese military to try to counter the Chinese influences. So therefore, India has consistently backed the Burmese military regime when it comes to people's democratic aspirations or struggle. Since the Obama administration, the Americans decided to bring the Burmese military from the cold because it did not want Burma to be too close to China. And so the U.S. accepted, you know, deeply flawed, even, you know, anti-democratic process dressed up as Myanmar Spring.
Back in 2011, the Obama administration was so excited to welcome Myanmar's democratic maneuver that the U.S. administration moved fast to remove the sanctions the U.S. imposed on the country earlier and restored the U.S. ambassador there. Barack Obama even paid a visit to Dosu's house in Yangon, where she had spent many years of detention. Now, the State Department has expressed support for the protesters, but what does it mean for their bilateral relations? Any adversarial move by the Biden administration would potentially push Myanmar to Beijing's orbit, which has described the coup as a major cabinet reshuffle.
When Suu Kyi finally made some sort of arrangement with the military and took power, she did not seem to be the same activist she was known and won a Nobel Award for. She was the actual top decision maker on many fundamental areas, including economy, healthcare, and education. However, not only she failed to end the country's drawn-out civil wars or recast Myanmar as a multicultural society, but also she sided with the executioners and denied the facts about the systematic genocide of Rohingya people by the military. She either went to The Hague to defend the military, perhaps to stay in power.
Roughly about 500,000 or 600,000 Rohingyas, and you know, there are about 100,000 are in IDP camps, where they have been kept, you know, against their will for the last 8 years. No livelihood opportunities, no school, no proper schooling, let alone universities. And you know, the 100,000 Rohingyas are languishing in these IDP camps, which German Foreign Office officials consider a concentration camp, you know, camps. And then, like, you've got another, you know, 400,000 plus that are scattered across the different parts of northern Rakhine, and they are in open prison camps from where they cannot leave. They can't move from one city to another. They cannot migrate, you know, legally. And so I think that their situation remains rather dire. And you know, with the release of you know, ex-genocidal nationalist Rakhines, a lot of Rohingyas fear that they may be scapegoated again for another round of violence.
Her newly recognized support for the military junta don't seem to be helping her now, but it may keep bothering her conscience, together with those of all members of the board that gave her the Nobel Prize. She may have started as the country's heroine of democracy, but this seems like one of those narratives whose protagonist passes the grey area and becomes a villain as soon as she or he gets to power.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
All right, now to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Nesan Lin, who's a coordinator at the Free Rohingya Coalition from Frankfurt. Mr. Lin, welcome to this show again. So what led to the military coup in Myanmar? Was it expected?
Yeah, we know that this will happen after the election because military-backed Proudhon Party lost in the election, and the ruling party have got the landslide victory. So it is very simple. The military chief, Mae Aung Lai, he has the personal ambition that he wants to become the president of the country, and he's going to retire in a few months. So he thought that, you know, his Proudhon Party will win in the election and he will become the president. But when his Proudhon Party lost in the election, he was just accusing there is irregularity in the voter list and there is the electoral fraud. Those all are the lame excuses. And finally, he said, they detained the Aung San Suu Kyi and the president and also the political activists and the parliament member and successfully coup the power. So it is not the first time in Myanmar. It is third time since 1962, only 5 years from between 1962 to 2021. Only 5 years the civilian government ruled the country, but the civilian government didn't have the full power. But military was the military had the de facto power.
So, Mr. Lin, what will happen to the popular protests in the country right now? And how are these protests different from the protests that we saw in the past?
I was a young boy during the 1988 uprising. But if I have to compare with this 88 uprising and the now 2021, so now they have the curfew. They cannot assembly, you know, more than, they cannot gather more than five people, but they are still on, they take to the street and protesting, you know, 10 of thousands of people, and maybe across the country, a few million people are every day, you know, they are marching to somewhere and protesting the this military. So I think, you know, even the curfew cannot stop these people. So they are organizing the protests. The protests are increasing day by day. And this is also not going the pressure because, you know, in the beginning, the military charged the Aung San Suu Kyi with the, you know, export-import law. Now they added the another, you know, the national disaster law. And, you know, the president also. So they are not going to release. They are arresting the people every day. So they are not going to release. So what they need is, what we need is a strong international pressure. Like, you know, the U.S. already imposed a sanction, but you, the, most of the people from Myanmar, they are asking the U.S. military intervention.
Mr. Lin, before moving ahead, let's just please take a look at how the global media has covered this issue, and then we can come back.
A big concern is whether there will be violence or a public backlash against the military. Anticipating the coup, Suu Kyi, in a prepared statement, called for non-violent opposition. But the country is like a tinderbox, and a small incident could lead to conflagration. As important, there's every possibility that ongoing conflicts against ethnic armed groups could escalate. The crackdown on any dissent will undoubtedly extend to border states that are dominated by ethnic minorities, raising the risk of intensified conflict. The UN Security Council, China, the European Union, and the United States, among others, have urged the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN regional grouping, to help mediate in the crisis. The Indonesian plan also calls for ASEAN to facilitate dialogue between the junta and protesters, according to two officials and a third source familiar with it. Indonesia is pushing Southeast Asian neighbors to agree on an action plan over Myanmar's coup that would keep the junta to its promise of holding elections with monitors to ensure they are fair and inclusive. The takeover, coming against the backdrop of a deepening U.S.-China rivalry, pits the foreign policy strategies of the two powers against each other, and it thrusts Myanmar on the front lines of an increasingly tense geopolitical competition for global leadership. The U.S. has framed its approach to Myanmar as a push for democracy and human rights. The focus of Beijing, which says it has a policy of non-interference in the domestic affairs of other countries, has largely been on economic and strategic interests. The differences were clear in the response by the two nations to the coup. While U.S. social networks have often been reluctant to pick sides in political disputes, Facebook is taking direct steps to stop distribution of the military's narrative in the country. The company is curbing the reach of its information team and spokesperson, Brigadier General Zor Min Toon, adding this same action will be applied to any additional pages that the army controls that repeatedly violate our misinformation policies, it said in a statement.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Lin. So, Mr. Lin, what are the consequences that you foresee in terms of the condition of the Rohingya and this coup?
Rohingya, let me talk about the Rohingya inside the country. There are about the 600,000 Rohingya, about 140,000 are in the concentration camp since 2012, and the remaining are in the open-air prison. So we are in the worst situation since 1992. We have no freedom of movement, very little access to the education, the healthcare. and all are, you know, they repeated. So they have, you know, already wiped off the majority of the people. Now they are taking shelter in Bangladesh. So what we are worried is, this May Online Matter 2 chief has said, you know, this is the Rohingya genocide is and finished business. So now he has the full power, and nobody can stop him. We are really worried for the people remaining inside the country. Maybe he can launch a violence against them and wipe up the remaining people from there. So at the same time, he said he will bring the refugee from, he used the term internally displaced, the people from the Bangladesh according to the agreement, bilateral agreement they had. So we are also really worried, you know, these people will be pushed back from Bangladesh, because Bangladesh is really happy with this, you know, the letter sent by the military regime to the Bangladesh government. So we are really worried, you know, these people will be repatriated without citizenship protection and ethnic rights and the right to return to the original villages.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Lin, for being with us on our show. Unfortunately, that marks the end of our question and answer session. Many people have voiced their opinions on cyberspace and social media. Let's just take a quick look.
Matthew Tostevin tries to reflect the mass anti-coup demonstrations in Yangon, Myanmar. Karen Kin believes that while the people are empty-handed against the Juna and their weaponry, the power of people is more. Kenneth Roth refers to the deployment of an infantry division by the junta to defend the coup. He also mentions that according to the UN rapporteur, the division is responsible for the atrocities against the Rohingya. Although Muhammad Pakravan supports the movement against the junta, he criticizes the mainstream of the Democrats for being silent on the Rohingya issue, and he believes such a democracy won't last long and it's natural.
And that was our episode covering the coup d'etat in Myanmar and the whole story behind the decades-long internal conflict. We'll meet next week.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Two-thirds of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine doses delivered to Belgium have yet to be distributed to vaccination centres, officials have admitted, as the country became the latest in Europe to report a sharp rise in coronavirus infections. Belgium said infections were up 24% compared with the previous week, at a daily average of 2,300. All age groups were affected except for over 80s. Who have been prioritized for vaccinations. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled Belgium Slow to Distribute Oxford Vaccine Doses as COVID Cases Rise. Stay with us for more of Daniel Buffy's article. Two-thirds of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine doses delivered to Belgium have yet to be distributed to vaccination centres, officials have admitted, as the country became the latest in Europe to report a sharp rise in coronavirus infections. Belgium said infections were up 24% compared with the previous week, at a daily average of 2,300. All age groups were affected except the over-80s. Who have been prioritized for vaccinations. The development appears to be part of a worrying trend for health authorities across the European Union, with the European Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, the ECDC, reporting that, as of last Sunday, 13 countries had seen a week-on-week rise in infection rates. Angela Merkel said this week that Germany was heading into a third wave. The Belgian authorities, among others, are facing growing pressure to explain the slow progress of their vaccine programs, with just 4.5% of the adult population having had a vaccine jab, compared with 27% in the United Kingdom. Across the whole of the European Union, around 8% of the adult population has received a vaccine. On Friday, 26th of February, the Belgian Federal Medicine Agency said that of the 201,600 AstraZeneca doses delivered to the country, only 67,000 had been dispatched to vaccination centres. Jan Strubans, the manager of the Spoor Oost vaccination centre in Antwerp, told Belgium's Radio 1 that the lack of vaccines in his stores was holding him back. "It surprises me. We're only waiting for the vaccines. For next week, our agenda is empty," he said. "We need a few days to summon people, but there is no point in summoning them if we don't have vaccines yet, because we might have to call them back. When we are sure we get the rest of the vaccines, we will start giving them." Dirk Remakers, the head of the Belgian Vaccination Task Force, blamed the Anglo-Swedish pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca's erratic delivery schedule for the hold-up. He said, "First of all, there is a lot of uncertainty about the vaccine deliveries. AstraZeneca will only announce very late when and how many vaccines they will deliver, and it often involves varying volumes. It has therefore been decided not to start scheduling vaccines until they have been effectively delivered. So the vaccination centres cannot send out invitations until they know how many vaccines they will receive and when. To give everyone enough time to schedule such an appointment, we count on a lead time of 2 weeks between delivery and the effective application of the vaccine." AstraZeneca has been forced to heavily cut deliveries to member states of the European Union in the first quarter of this year, owing to a lower-than-expected yield from its European production sites. Of the 120 million doses due, only around 40 million are expected to arrive. But in the light of the infection surge, questions are being raised as to why only 27,946,395 of the 38,669,316 vaccine doses delivered by suppliers to member states have been administered. The discrepancy appears to be partly caused by a lack of administration of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Using data extracted from the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, the ECDC, and other official sources, it is estimated that 4,849,752 of the 6,134,707 AstraZeneca doses distributed among the 27 EU member states have not been yet administered. The Guardian newspaper revealed on Thursday that Belgium had received 201,600 AstraZeneca doses but had administered just 9,832 of them, or 4%. In an interview with a German newspaper this week, Angela Merkel said the AstraZeneca vaccine had an acceptability problem among some circles, following a slew of bad publicity, including French President Emmanuel Macron's unsubstantiated claim that it was quasi-effective for older age groups. However, a failure of logistics is increasingly being cited as a further issue in the rollout of the vaccine by people involved in programs in a number of EU member states. According to data from the ECDC, the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, which may be subject to a reporting time lag, Hungary had administered 44.6% of its total vaccine stockpile as of Friday, 26th of February. The Netherlands, 64.4%, and Belgium had administered 65.5% of its total vaccine stockpiles. On Friday, following a meeting with senior politicians and health officials, Belgium's Prime Minister Alexander De Croo said he had hoped to announce a relaxation of the national lockdown, but that the extent of the infection was too grave. "We did not make the decision in consultation committee that we thought we would take," he said. "The corona situation remains extremely delicate. We were on a high plateau, but the figures are now rising again. The coronavirus infections, but especially the hospital admissions too. The numbers are rising everywhere, and that forces us to remain particularly cautious."
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Halfway. On this week's show, we'll be looking at the economy of Cuba and ascertain just how the island nation in the Caribbean is reforming its private sector to assist the flow of income to the people of Cuba. With the Cuban Revolution led by Fidel Castro in 1953, took 5 years to oust then-President Fulgencio Batista, is still in place today, which on a political scale saw the U.S. very nervous of its communist neighbor, leading to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Yet today sees the revolution as part of the brand of Cuba. However, a major impact on the Cuban economy are U.S.-imposed sanctions on the state, which along with the impact of the COVID-19 virus saw Cuba's GDP fall by some 11% since the year, or since the start of the year 2020, and along with the state governing most enterprises, has given Cuba a very low score on the Index of Economic Freedom, showing the score sinking to just 26.9 points. Well, by not having a significant flow of foreign currencies, Cuba has stumbled on a difficult situation, as the nation, for example, imports around